on.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. We have a special treat tonight in that we don't usually do this. Well, you're sort of a standard treat. Okay. I wouldn't say necessarily a special one. But what I would say is that, weirdly enough, we're going to talk about nothing but Arena League football this weekend, because apparently that's what the Seahawks Cowboys game is going to resemble.
I was like, where are we going? Where are we going, Mike?
No, this is going to be a mighty defensive struggle, right?
That's kind of what I'm expecting. Well, okay, so two things. Right. One, logically, as someone who watches football and has seen these two teams, what I'm expecting is a shootout. That's right. What most people are expecting. When you look at just the stats only, not players, not anything else, these two offenses have been phenomenal. And not just phenomenal, but like putting up a ton of points, a ton of yards, a ton of touchdowns. And then on the flip side, the defenses have really struggled, and both defenses have dealt with season-ending injuries.
Right.
Okay. Two things that kind of match up to a shootout, right?
Right.
On the flip side, I think that there is enough really on either defense, but I think specifically Seattle, to come together at some point. Do I think the strength of this team this year will be its defense? No. I think that there are defensive players on Seattle's team that are some of the best in the league. It's not a knock on individual players, and because of that, I almost feel like not informed or bad saying it. Like, these are not just likable guys, but really talented players. It just hasn't been able to come together yet. And I wonder if that's a little bit of an overreaction to 2 weeks. We knew heading into the season that the defensive line, just the four guys up front, would struggle. Since they traded away Frank Clark, they just haven't been able to be productive there. And part of that is you haven't really had like a lot of money and draft capital to spend. You don't have Jadeveon Clowney anymore. You don't have a first-round pickup on your D-line. Your second-round pick that was supposed to come in and really help you had to start the season on the NFI list, which keeps him out of football for 6 weeks. So you're in a rough spot, and you were already in one heading into the season. But we thought that the linebacker group and that the secondary were going to be really good. And they do have the most talent on that team. Despite that, you've seen Seattle give up more yards through 2 weeks than the best offense in the league has gained. I mean, that is really something. It's not by a ton. It's by like 30 or 40 yards. But
nonetheless,
the most yards happening in games is being given up by the Seahawks defense. I don't expect that to continue. We talked about it before. I would expect some kind of regression to a mean. Football games don't really... There's not as many outliers as I think we like to imagine in sports. Like, when they happen, it's exciting and it's rare, but that's why it would be so hard to repeat a 2,000-yard rushing season. You know what I mean? Like, that's why those things are so hard to do. And that happens with bad stuff, too. I don't expect defenses to give up 450 yards a game, because it is very hard for quarterbacks to gain 450 passing yards a game. Like, they are very, very difficult to do. That's a lot of offensive production from a team. So I don't expect that trend to continue. I think that they have a chance to right the ship a little bit against Dallas, which is surprising to say because Dallas's offense is so good.
Right.
But Dallas is entering the game without their starting right tackle. They've got an undrafted rookie free agent there, meaning someone that signed with the team who was not drafted and just signed with the team. This will be his third ever game in the NFL. On the other side, you've got your left tackle who is questionable for the game and may not play. So there's an opportunity there to get some pressure. You've got really good wide receivers, but you've also got some cornerbacks that are gaining a bit of confidence. The injury report, you know, while we're just talking about Seattle's injuries heading into the game, starting defensive end Benson Mayoa was on it.
Right.
Starting, you know, cornerback Quentin Dunbar was on it. Pete Carroll said that both of those guys should play. So that's good news. So it's looking a little more promising heading into the game.
All right, lightning round questions before we go into any more details. Who scores first?
Seattle.
Who scores last?
The winner.
Not necessarily. I mean, the Seahawks could have a huge lead in the Cowboys.
No, I think the last... What I'm saying is I think the last person the ball wins.
So who is that going to be?
Seattle.
Okay, so Seattle scores first. Seattle scores last. Who scores on a turnover?
I think Seattle, and I don't say that with bias, Dallas is going to be without their one of their starting corners and potentially another starting corner. So they could have at least two backups in their secondary.
All right. I'm just writing all these. This is actually going to be, if you hear this clicking noise. That is me writing this down.
Really taking notes.
Really taking notes. We are going to revisit this on Monday. We're going to do the Stacey Ross test. So that's Seattle, Seattle, and Seattle, easy enough for me to remember. And we will get to this at the end. The last of the lightning round questions, of course, is you going to be predicting the score. So I'm going to let you, I'm going to give you time now to figure that out.
I want to change my answer. I'm going to say Dallas scores first. I know you wrote it in pen. I'm going to say it just doesn't feel right. I feel like I answered B too many times on a test. You know what I mean? I'm going to say Dallas scores
it's
first.
It's not a bad bet, though.
Seattle scores last, and Seattle has the first turnover.
Okay, so let's recap her answers. Dallas scores first. Seattle scores last. Seattle scores on a turnover, correct?
Yeah.
All right, that's what we got for game prediction. We will come up with a game prediction score at the end of the segment. So let's talk a couple more specifics. Who, other than Russell Wilson, who is set for a big game on offense for Seattle? We know Russ.
Right.
Beyond Russ, who's got a big game coming?
I think you got to go back to the wide receivers, Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf. You can just see, I don't want to say the connection between Wilson and Lockett. They're already on the same page. They've been performing together really well for years. You can see that connection growing with Metcalf again in his second year. He was phenomenal. I think had over 90 yards last week, in addition to a couple big completions. I think that he is maybe third or fourth in the entire league in yards per reception. So he's being targeted on some big, deep passes, and he's beating guys one-on-one. He beat, you know, last year's defensive player of the year in so many one-on-one matchups. I mean, that is so rare for a second-year player to do against one of the best cornerbacks in the game. So I think that he's set for another good game against what could be some guys that are, you know, either lacking in experience or a little injured, a little banged up. They've still, Dallas has playmakers on defense. Don't get me wrong. This is not going to be a cakewalk. If Seattle wins, it won't just be because Dallas was struggling with injuries. They've got guys on there that are going to make it difficult for them. That's
right,
for sure. But it'll also be because Seattle knew how to attack them and where to attack them, and they did it well.
All right. So who on Dallas do you expect is going to have a big game on offense? And that actually includes anyone there.
Yeah. Oh, man. I think Zeke Elliott is probably set for a big game. Bruce Irvin was really, really good. This was pointed out by Mike Salk, who was on with us earlier, but he was especially concerned with Bruce Irvin being done for the season, as was I, because I think back to the game against Atlanta, they came out running early, which was a surprise for them. It was unexpected. They had thrown the ball all over the place last year, led the entire league in pass attempts, and yet the first three plays of the game, they're running Gurley, a running back who Seattle's familiar with but hasn't ever played in Atlanta. So it's a new team. It's something you weren't expecting. And Gurley was playing pretty well. And honestly, like, they really only turned away from Gurley when they started falling behind and had to pass. But I will say, one of the only reasons Gurley wasn't able to gain more is because Bruce Irvin was getting in there on a lot of those run stops and securing the edge, kind of keeping Gurley from, or any of the running backs, from kind of breaking away, you know, running toward the sideline and gaining yardage there. He was quick. He was effective, an effective tackler. I mean, he played so well. I think that you now in his place have a rookie who, this wasn't really like his job at Texas Tech. He was a middle linebacker, so he was playing Bobby Wagner's role.
Right.
Obviously, you're still in on that, but the tasks are a little bit different. He does have experience playing outside linebacker, but again, I think that people are underestimating the impact Bruce Irvin had even in just two games here. So I'm a little worried that what you could see is a guy like Zeke Elliott having a pretty big day.
Right. In fact, you know, if you want to talk about veteran players, I think it was, you have to correct me on this, but it was Bobby Wagner. Mm-hmm. I mean, the goal line stop against New England was, I mean, there was another player who actually did the tackle, but apparently it was Bobby Wagner who let everyone know what was going to happen. And so losing another veteran linebacker, I mean, obviously Bobby Wagner is playing, but losing Bruce Irvin, you also lose that person who kind of knows what mm-hmm. might be happening. And you put a rookie in there and they don't actually know what's going to be happening. And that actually affects the entire linebacking core, if not the defensive line as well.
And it's such a savvy decision to make, too, that I don't know many young players could make. I mean, the Patriots had run essentially that same play to the other side before. Mm-hmm. They'd run it to the right. They'd run it to the left. But basically a very similar look. And Seattle had guessed wrong before. Newton had been very effective in that situation. He'd already scored from essentially a very similar play. But to be able to pick up on what looks like something you've seen before that was running the other way and just say, like, I'm feeling like they're going to go right instead of left. Just the smallest details that I'm not privy to. Like, I don't think that way. I can't understand. I know a fraction of what any player knows. Even the worst player in the league knows more than any of us about football. So, but that's something where you talk about when you lose players, you're hinting at it now. When you lose players, you don't just lose someone's physical ability on the field. You lose very important veteran presence.
Absolutely.
You lose Bruce Irvin out there communicating with guys, hyping guys up, you know, whether it's good play Rook or whether it's saying like, hey, this guy's going over here, or knowing, you know, what a play looks like. He's been playing for the better part of a decade.
Right. I mean, what we don't recognize, and I think that you're really spot on here, and I hadn't really thought about it, but so if there's a key play, we break it down and like, then we find out, well, turns out that Bobby Wagner was the guy who let him know, like, blah, blah, blah. That happens
in a second.
60 times a game, though. I mean, like a lot of the plays that we don't necessarily break down because we don't understand them as pivotal at that moment, mm-hmm. even though sometimes they are.
But they're only not pivotal because they were able to correctly diagnose it, or maybe there was a flub on the offense.
Or it was just a way that you kept 5 yards into 2 yards,
yeah.
like consistently,
yep.
like by giving somebody advice. And when you lose that, you don't lose that for that play. You lose that for the entire game, those mm-hmm. tiny adjustments that they make. I mean, sometimes they don't make all the adjustments, but we don't know what we've lost until he's out of there. And so I think you're right. That's a really good point. And plus, I mean, a Gurley Elliott 1-2 punch in running back is significant, I think, for any team with a great offensive
line. And Dak
much less the Seahawks
is also able to do this. I mean, he last week had 4 touchdowns. 3 of those were rushing touchdowns. I mean, he is an effective scrambler. He isn't exactly the same kind of quarterback as Russell Wilson, but he is able to beat you with his legs.
Absolutely,
like he knows when to run, knows when to slide.
Right.
He can score. I mean, this is yet another quarterback for a second consecutive week for Seattle, where you've got to be aware that this guy can run on you too.
All right, another lightning round question just popped into my head.
Okay.
Who gives up more yards on defense?
Seattle.
All right, I'm writing it down right now. The pen is going. Seattle. All right. Back to the regular questions then. Okay, so we have, is anyone on Seattle's defense going to have to step up and have a big game? Or is this 1,000%. Going to be just damage control, like the bend but don't break defense, which is not a great, it doesn't have the rings the way Legion of Boom, but that kind of is who they are.
Yeah, B2BB. We'll figure it out later. It'll be very intimidating. Yes, to answer your question, I would say one of these guys, and it's not fair, but it's going to have to happen. It falls on rookie Jordan Brooks.
Right.
I think he's number 56. I'm pretty sure he'll be. He has had snaps so far. He has been in games, but he hasn't started yet. He is expected to start potentially in Bruce Irvin's role. They might slide KJ around and maybe have Brooks play on the other side at the weak side linebacker spot. But I think we're all just assuming he'll be in there in Bruce Irvin's role. That's a lot to ask for a player, and he's going to make mistakes. Like, and the thing is, like, the offense knows he's new too. The offense knows, why would I go to this side? Why would I go over here and risk running into Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright, who are both phenomenal players, when I could target this guy who's had a handful of, NFL snaps.
Right.
He's got a lot on his plate this Sunday, and I don't envy him. Like, he's a phenomenal player. He was by far, everyone we talked to around draft day said, this guy I'm really excited about. Brock Huard, I think Jordan Brooks was his favorite player from the draft. So he has so much potential, but the thing, when you're a rookie in sports, you're learning in front of everyone. Millions of people are watching you learn your job on the fly. And, again, I don't envy that position, but I think that he is one of the players, if not the player, who's going to have the biggest day. I would be remiss if I also didn't mention the secondary, though. I'm going to say this every week, that Jamal Adams, and I think, let's just go with the whole secondary. Quandre Diggs being back out there at safety with Jamal Adams, and then you've got both your corners, Quentin Dunbar and Shaquille Griffin. It is going to be up to them to stop Dallas's pretty lethal passing attack. They have Michael Gallup, who is great. CeeDee Lamb, a rookie who's really starting to kind of get in the swing of things. Amari Cooper, their leader and one of the best in the game. I mean, that's a tall task. I mean, it'll be like this again when they face the Rams, who have one of the best, if not the best, receiver group in football. But this is going to be a lot for them. So I'll put it on Brooks in the front seven, and then I'll just say the complete secondary.
All right, so little off base question, but
no,
let's just say
we only talk sports.
No, off base about sports.
Oh, okay,
but I just want to, and I'm not trying to no doom and gloom here, but let's just say that this game doesn't turn out for the Seahawks the way we would like for it to.
So it's a loss.
Do you feel like this is one of those games where it is going to go at least some way, if not a long way, in determining if the Seahawks go out searching for free agents?
Wow, that's a good question. I think they're going to have to do that regardless.
Right.
I think that the loss of Irvin and the fact that Daryl Taylor was not able to start the year with the team, I think they expected him to be able to. The way I interpret Pete Carroll when he talks about it is that they knew it would be tough for him. He's coming off of surgery. He had like essentially a steel bar put in his leg back in January or so.
Right.
That this was going to be tough, but I think they still expected him to be able to break camp with the team. So maybe they've been looking since then and they haven't found a fit, but I would think that no matter the outcome, they're looking. With a loss, they maybe move their what they're willing to do, whether it's what they're willing to pay, who they're willing to sign. There's like a, not desperation, but a little bit of an air of urgency there that may not be there otherwise. I think
right.
If you have a great game from Benson Mayowa, who should play, if you have a great game from Jordan Brooks, maybe you feel a little bit better about the guys you have. But either way, it's something they're very aware of. Like, we aren't out here talking about how the pass rush is being inconsistent and with Pete Carroll being like, what are you talking about? What?
Right.
I don't see that. I mean, they know
right.
exactly what's wrong with their team, what's right with their team, exactly what their options are, more than any of us do. So I wouldn't be surprised if they're having a lot of these conversations right now.
Right. All right. So we are at that moment. Where?
Hi.
Where? No,
oh, where
no,
I do
no,
a guess.
No, no,
okay.
You can't. No, I know you wanted to flee for more of this.
Sorry, I have a phone call.
I'm busy this weekend.
I know, I can't do it. Okay.
All right. So here is the big time where you get
exactly what the score is going to be.
And we have all right. So we've got four lightning round questions, and then a score prediction. And remember, if I could just recap from our earlier conversation, the Dallas Cowboys score. First,
okay.
So your score prediction for the and forgive me for not knowing this, I should, but I guess because no one's going to the games anyway, maybe it's more irrelevant. Where are we playing? Are we playing there? Are they playing here?
They are playing here.
They're playing here. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So who is going to win this game and by how much?
Okay, it's going to be Seattle.
Seattle, writing it down right now.
Okay, I've actually changed my mind on the score prediction. Earlier, I said it would be like 41-38, but if I'm going to say that the defense is going to be able to make some plays, I have to back it up.
All right.
Put my score prediction and myself on the line here. I'm going to go 41-28.
41-28.
Seattle.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
Remember
then.
That. Write that down in pen, and then if
it
that doesn't happen, forget
in...
I said it.
Yeah, right.
I'm going to
no,
go
no.
and I'm going to delete this audio.
Oh no. No, we're going to be talking about this on Monday. We've got the whole lightning round to go over, and 41 for Seattle, correct?
Yeah.
Not Dallas. All right.
Yep.
All right. 41 for Dallas. Stacey Joe, thank you very much for joining us once again. And we will see you. Well, you'll be working all weekend. The rest of us hopefully won't be, but we'll be talking again on Monday to do the Truth Squad, these answers you've provided.
I'm not going to remember. I'm going to have very selective memories. I'm going to be like, no, all I remember saying is that Dallas would score first. I don't know.
The rest of it just didn't happen.
I don't remember what you're talking about. That's weird.
All right, Stacey. Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up, a fantastic interview with Dr. Jim DeMaine, his new book, Facing Death, Finding Dignity, Hope, and Healing in the End. He was a professor of medicine at the University of Washington, a clinician for group health, dealt with a lot of dying people, and he has got a very interesting perspective on a healthy way to approach death. That is coming up after the break. welcome back to Cairo Nights. This has been, I think by anyone's estimation, a year where we've dealt with a lot of death. 200,000 people now have died from coronavirus. But this isn't about coronavirus as much as it is about the way we approach death. And can death actually be a healing process? We're joined now with Jim DeMaine. He's a doctor. He was a pulmonary critical care specialist and a clinical professor of medicine at the University of Washington. And his new book, Facing Death, talks about the way we approach death. Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So this book is remarkable in the way it approaches this idea of death as not being something to be. I mean, obviously, we're all scared of it. And obviously, that's one of the things that we all have in common is we're going to get there someday.
Right.
Tell for the folks who aren't as familiar with this idea, tell us a little bit. Give us a synopsis of your book, or give the listeners a synopsis of your book, which I thoroughly am enjoying.
Well, thank you. The book is really a book of stories, because that's kind of the way I think. I started writing these down after I retired, and I think people learn from stories, seeing what other people have done, how they've handled death and dying within their families, and how to have a conversation, how to listen intently, how to handle conflicts, what options are at the end. All these things I dealt with over the years. I would deal with it daily in my life in critical care, and found that a lot of people, when they got to that point, it was like deer in the headlights. They'd never had a conversation. They'd never really thought about the end. William Saroyan says, everybody has got to die, but I always believe an exception would be made in my case. I think, denial is good. You know, we need to get on with our everyday lives, for sure. But I think periodically we need to step back and really seriously think about it. And my hope is that we can begin to have more conversation about what death means to us and what matters the most around that time. In other words, how would we envision a good death for ourselves? And then how can we find an advocate? How can we communicate our wishes? And most importantly, how can we make sure that once we maybe fill out all the forms and everything, how can we be sure that people are going to pay attention, when that time comes?
We're talking with Dr. Jim DeMaine. His new book, Facing Death, this is from a lifetime of clinical work with people who are facing death. Jim, how did you decide on who it is that you selected, the stories you selected for this particular book?
Well, there's multiple stories. I wanted to feature both people that really did good planning, and then some problem situations, and also where there were some conflicts, because that's reality. I mean, things don't always go smoothly at that time, because emotions run high, particularly if there's conflict in families, if there's drug abuse, or if there's alcoholism, or, some kind of dysfunctional atmosphere, then things can flare up. So I wanted to point out all kinds of different stories. And so it's really a number of vignettes with a little lesson that's implied in each one, trying to get us to think and, again, picture for ourselves what that might be like.
Well, what did you first, let me ask another question. Jim, how old are you?
I am now 81, almost 82.
82. You sound great, but what are these things, when you hear these stories from people? I mean, this book is not just about their stories, but it's also, to a degree, how it's shaped your own view of the end of your life. What did these people who you talked to and the stories that you include in the book, how did they affect you?
Well, quite a bit. When I go back and think about medical school, we were never taught about death and dying. If somebody had cancer, we weren't even supposed to tell them that. Denial and hiding was kind of the way we approached that. I think society has opened up more. We're willing to talk about it more. And I really gradually learned over time. My patients actually taught me lessons about the way they coped with their own deaths. I had one lady that had severe pulmonary hypertension. She was Asian descent from Guam initially, and she had just a very philosophical outlook on life. She got very, very ill at one point. I was suggesting that she go over to the University of Washington for a lung transplant, and she said, no, I really don't want to do that. I'm in the Lord's hands, and whatever happens, happens. And I had her husband come in because I was kind of worried that they might not understand, but they did. She went off to Guam with oxygen and everything to visit family before she died and sent me a nice postcard saying she was doing okay. But when she came back, she was very ill and was placed into hospice care. And I was beginning to lose track of her, except I would get notes from the hospice team. And then one day, the team called me up and said, you know, she would really like you to stop by the house. She really wants to see you once again. And so I left and knocked on the front door. This is over in Bellevue. And it's a very nice home in a modest neighborhood. And I could hear music coming from inside. And I said, my gosh, what's this? And so grandchild answered the door and called for his grandpa. And I walked in, and there were young kids running all around the house. And it was, the table was just piled with food. And there was my patient in a hospital bed right in the middle of all this, oxygen running, sleepy smile on her face. She was getting morphine given by the family just to help to control her symptoms, you know, all under the direction of the hospice nurses. And she just held my hand. She said, Dr. DeMaine, you must be tired. Why don't you get something to eat? So she was kind of taking care of me.
And wow.
Patients like that just taught me so much about the grace and beauty that we can pass on to our family if we can approach death with that kind of equanimity. Now, all the stories in the book obviously aren't that beautiful. I mean, there are others where people fought it up until the end or had post-traumatic stress problems that flared up. I mean, all kinds of issues come up. But I try to bring up these points in stories. And at the end of the book, for people that really want to proceed with their own planning, I have frequently asked questions that direct people to websites and resources in the community, you know, where they can actually do specific planning. There's very good books and websites that I note in that appendix to the book.
We're talking with Dr. Jim DeMaine. He was a pulmonary critical care specialist with Group Health. He also was a clinical professor of medicine. He's now a professor emeritus at the University of Washington School of Medicine. His new book, Facing Death, Finding Dignity, Hope, and Healing at the End. Jim, do you have any book signings, any events coming up where people can maybe see you at least on a Zoom call and learn a little bit more about your book and about your blog?
Yeah, thanks. My blog, first of all, is just endoflifeblog.com. And on that, I will list the events coming up. But the most immediate one is next Wednesday. We were going to do it on Tuesday, but that's the debate night for the election.
Oh, right.
So Wednesday at Brick and Mortar Books over in Redmond, 7 p.m. will be the link to the Zoom is on their website, and it's also on my website. And then there'll be an interview at Town Hall on November 16th with Katie Sewell. That might be well worth tuning into. And that, of course, will be on Town Hall's website. And then there's others as well, as you might imagine, that are coming up, and those will be posted on my website.
That was Jim DeMaine, Dr. Jim DeMaine, and his book, Facing Death, Finding Dignity, Hope, and Healing at the End. Jim, thank you so much for joining Cairo Nights.
Thank you, Mike. Much appreciated.
And coming up in the next hour, we are going to be talking, well, of course, we're going to be talking with Stacey Jo Ross, but we're also going to be talking to an expert on the new Supreme Court nominee, someone who did a lengthy profile on her, and what we know about why conservatives love her and why the Democrats are a little bit scared, coming up after the hour.
We might fall apart before too long. We can work it out. We can work it out.
Not only is it the end of the day, it's also the end of the week. It always feels like these weeks are longer and longer and longer and longer. I know it feels like that to you. What does everyone refer to it now? It's just Blur's Day.
Oh,
the entire week. But thank you for taking the ride with us. We will see you again on Monday. But before we go, we have to do that last little bit of venting of those things that we've been thinking about. Frank, what do you think?
I have something truly trivial.
Okay.
My wife and I went to Costco today and bought two Sonicare toothbrushes. It was a great deal. $66
for two. Probably only buy them by the pairs there, I'm assuming, or by the gross.
Yeah. You could get a palette. You know what? It's just fascinated me, and I just thought, wow, our world really has changed. They now put a microchip in the brush that you snap on to the machine so that it talks to the machine, and when the brush is done and it's time to change it out, it tells the toothbrush. Oh, my God.
Well, I mean, that's no different. It's the they just learned that from auto dealers, right? The check engine light is much more about triggering on mileage, so you go back to the dealer and get an expensive oil change and get that meter reset. This is them selling more toothbrushes. It has nothing to do with dental health.
Well, on average, these things last about 3 months, and I'm along with you on that. That's probably true, but it still freaks me out.
Understood.
You know?
Shane?
I've been doing my best to try to eat healthy, not eat a lot of sugar or anything bad.
Good.
But it's Friday. I've had a long week.
You have?
It's been a doozy of a week. And the only thing that's on my mind is as soon as I get out of here, I'm going straight to Dick's Cheeseburgers, and I'm going to get the most biggest disgusting meal of greasy burgers that you'll ever see, and I'm probably going to eat all of them in less than 5 minutes.
And you said something sweet, so I'm assuming a milkshake is going to be in the mix as well.
Ooh, I don't know.
Pretty good shakes at Dick's.
The shakes are really good, but with the cracked tooth and some of that stuff, I'll keep the sugar and the cold off of it, but a nice juicy burger, I can take that pain.
The good news is the burger, the juicy giant burger at Dick's, cost you $1.50.
Yeah.
It'll be great.
That's the best part.
So what's on my mind? I actually spent an hour on the Tom and Curly show today.
You did.
If you listen to the end of the Tom and Curly show. That lesser form of John was me, along with Dre's, who is a delight to work with. He's not only a smart guy, I love people who can bring in an opinion that I was actually not anticipating at all, and he usually is good for that. But it also reminded me about how nice it is sometimes to change up what your routine is and throw something else in the mix. I mean, it is a little bit of extra work to do, but the nice thing about it is it just doesn't ever allow you to have that feeling that you've got it done or that it's solved. It's nice for me. I think I operate better when there's just a little bit of worry in the air. I think that's just years of PTSD from newsrooms.
A touch of anxiety.
That I'm always a little bit sweating about what's coming next. So in a weird way, it kind of made the day pass a lot faster and a lot more efficiently. And always it's fun to get on that show with other folks as well and then just roll right into this one. So once again, thank you folks for joining us. We will see you again on Monday. And remember, as Frank likes to remind me, you can catch the show. If you missed it, you can catch the show on podcast. If you look up Cairo Nights Podcast, you will find the entire page of all of the shows. But you can ignore the other ones and just go straight to Cairo Nights. Thank you. Have a good weekend. And so as you tremble, you know what to do. Sometimes if I shout